This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Stories of strong girls and women working in their own small way to iron out persistent imbalances in gender equality inspire us to do better every day. One such woman is Marianne Clark Hutting, the representative in Malaysia for the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, who is using her passion and skills to create a better world for all children, particularly girls. She joins me now to discuss her work in human rights advocacy. Welcome, Marianne. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, Julia. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. So maybe, Marianne, we could start a little bit about, you know, finding out about you. You know, tell me about your early years. You know, what kind of, I suppose, values were you brought up with? Were you always taught to be strong and independent?
I think I was very lucky. I was born the last child to elderly parents, I would say. There's a big difference between my sisters and I. And yet my parents had always pushed us, three girls that we are, to get an education, to become independent. And that's something that they valued. I think I appreciate that, seeing us much more now when I look back on what they grew up with and through the war. So the values that we had were really to be independent, not to have to depend on a man, for example, for our own livelihood, but to be able to get a job and to fulfill our full potential, to respect ourselves, to respect others, to have empathy for others, those kind of values, and family values as well. And to be frugal, to value what we had, to value what money could bring and what you earn.
Mm-hmm. So basically, universally, just wonderful values to be brought up with.
Yeah, well, I feel very grateful for my parents for having instilled those in me.
And why would you say that they were slightly different with you because you were the youngest? I'm the youngest as well, and I know why my parents, you know, raised me very differently from the way they raised my elder siblings. But why would you say your parents had that slight, maybe different approach?
I think generationally, it was almost like a generation apart, and they could see that things had changed. When my sisters were born, it was just after the war, and so times were still very difficult. You know, you still had coupons for food and things like that. Mm-hmm. When I came along, it was very much the baby boomers, and there was a lot more opportunity, and they wanted me to avail of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you did. So were there any role models you had who inspired you when you were growing up?
I think, well, I went to girls' schools predominantly, especially in my secondary schools. There were a lot of female teachers, my headmistress as well. She was somebody who really pushed us, who was a very independent woman herself, very successful. You know, she drove a Ferrari and was very, and that was to us, wow. You know? But that's on the materialistic side. But she was somebody who'd made it and really pushed us girls to get a university education, which at that time in that school wasn't, you know, the tradition. So that was definitely one of my role models. And then I think later in life, women like Louise Arbour, who was the Prime Minister in Ireland, but also then the Human Rights Commission, really worked to integrate human rights into the whole UN agenda. And she, to me, was definitely one of my inspirations when I started out in my career.
And maybe you could tell me a bit about that. You know, what got you interested in, you know, getting into this sort of work, you know, human rights advocacy, you know, working with the UN?
Yeah, I think at the beginning, I wasn't really sure. You know, I wanted to discover the world. And so I got my first job teaching in China, and I decided to go overland from the UK to China. And at that time, there was still the Berlin Wall, and going by train from West to Eastern Europe was already a huge eye-opener. And I got to know people in Poland, and then that already was, for me, an eye-opener in that, you know, I thought, wow, I could have been born here, and my life would have been so very different from what it was. So that was the first thing. Then when I arrived in China, and at that time, it was just the beginning of the open-door policy. It was still a very closed country, and you couldn't really frequent the Chinese. So my friends became the foreign students who were there, mm-hmm. you know, students from Palestine, from Africa. And that also made me realize that, you know, there's something wrong if people have to come, you know, be dependent on the charity of another country, go very far from their family and homes, to get an education. So I felt that I wanted to learn more about that and to right this wrong. And that's what motivated me. And I went back to university and I did a master's in economic development. Mm-hmm. And then the rest is history.
So what is that history? I mean, how did you first get into the UN itself? What was the first role that you sort of got in while working within the UN?
The first role first I started with non-for-profits. But when I first got into the UN, I was sponsored by the British government as their first junior professional officer to UNICEF. They'd sponsored for other organizations, but I was the first one they sponsored to UNICEF. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1992. And there's no guarantee when you get that you will then get a job with the UN. But I was lucky. I was given responsibility for a project, which then I developed into the first child protection program in Madagascar. Mm-hmm. And then I got the job to head that program and stayed on with UNICEF from there. I've left UNICEF in between a couple of times, but I've come back and it's definitely my agency of choice.
It just keeps calling you, doesn't it? You mentioned some works that you used to work with NGOs. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that, the sort of work you did there.
Yeah, I've worked with the Thai Chinese Refugee Service in Thailand and also with the International Federation of Red Cross in Malawi, mostly working in humanitarian assistance with refugees, Cambodian refugees, Lao refugees and Vietnamese in Thailand, and then those from Mozambique in Malawi. That was the first work. And then I also worked with Save the Children and set up their the office in Bulgaria. At that time, it was just they were aspiring to join the EU. There was the whole crisis or discovery of children in institutions and the whole deinstitutionalization of children and decentralized government, helping governance. So that was very interesting work, very different as well.
And I'm sure you must have had some very eye-opening experiences there, especially, working in the refugee camps, for example. Maybe you could share some of those experiences with me.
Yeah, I think one thing that's striking when you work with refugees is, first of all, you're struck by the horrors that that one human can inflict on another, mm-hmm. and the horrors of war, mm-hmm. and conflict, especially on women and children. But women seem to bear the brunt of war and conflict because of mass rape. When I was in Guinea with UNICEF, we were working with the refugees who'd come from Liberia and Sierra Leone. And you heard stories which you sort of wonder how low we can stoop as humans to inflict this kind of suffering on others. You know, whether you heard of women who were pregnant having their stomachs opened, their fetus taken out, being made to pulp those babies with a hammer and pestle. Mass rapes, taking over, being taken as sex slaves and girls as well. And then you are just taken in awe by the extreme resilience of these women to rebuild their lives, to carry on, to take care of the children or their siblings that they have been left responsible for. And and that strength of character is really awe-inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I think those are some of the biggest lessons that I have taken away from that, that, with the right help and support, people can rebuild their lives. And it's sometimes hard to believe how people get over it, but they do. And even in Somalia, when I've worked there, you see the incredible resilience of the people there, and especially the women. They remain the backbone, I think, to a lot of these societies and a lot of strong women in all these countries.
And I think it goes back to what you said, earlier, that had you been born in a different situation in a different country, your path might have been so much different. So it's important for those of us who were fortunate enough to be born, not facing war, not facing such strife, to help those who aren't so fortunate as us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important as well to recognize that war can happen at any time. Conflict can happen at any time. And whilst we live in a little bubble, then, you know, it can that was the Second World War, okay, but now look at even at Syria. Syrians had such a high standard of living and education and so on, and yet now that country has been reduced to rubble and a whole generation of children have been robbed of their childhood, even in countries such as Iraq, which had also quite high level of education and development. So you never know when it's going to hit. So it may be them today. It could be us tomorrow. Yeah. And that empathy and acknowledgement is important, I think.
I'm speaking today to Marianne Clark-Harting. She is the representative in Malaysia for the United Nations Children Fund, or UNICEF. And we're talking about her work and also, you know, how she's helping to create a better world for women and girls around the world. We'll find out more after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Marianne Clark-Harting. She is a representative in Malaysia for UNICEF, or the United Nations Children Fund. And we're discussing how, you know, through her work, she's helping to create a better world for girls and women. Marianne, would you identify as a feminist yourself?
It's not a word I like, the feminism. Mm-hmm. I think it has a militant tone to it. However, I'm a firm believer in equal opportunity, equal rights for women, and I don't believe in sort of gender stereotypical roles for men and women. Within my own household, within my life, I think the you know, obviously my husband has chosen to follow me, and that was a choice because he realized that, you know, I could earn more and I had a better career. Mm-hmm. So he was happy to support. I think that's quite unusual, unfortunately, for many women. But, you know, within the household as well, you both need to eat, you both need to have clean clothes, you both want children. And therefore, I firmly believe that, you know, both have a role to play within that. It shouldn't just be the woman's role to, you know, to do the shopping and cooking and to defer to her husband. Mm-hmm. So those are the values that I live by. And those are things that I like to believe I work for as well, and fight for in my work.
So how do you sort of bring those ideals into your own work through UNICEF, for example?
Well, UNICEF is a strong upholder for women's rights and the girl child's rights globally. Well, for all children's rights. But around the world, you see that, you know, in terms of education for girls, they are often the ones who are least educated or have less opportunity to go to school. Mm-hmm. They're often the ones who, you know, are married off earlier. And, you know, so you have other child rights violations like female genital mutilation and so on. So I think in all those areas, as well as gender-based violence, sexual exploitation and so on, girls are always the ones who are most affected by these. And therefore, you know, UNICEF upholds those rights. We work with governments. We do a lot of advocacy. We try and bring in, we support legislative change and policy change to protect girls from these human rights violations.
Back in October, we just celebrated International Day of the Girl Child. And, you know, I heard a few people commenting, you know, why a day just for girls? And how would you respond to something like that?
I'd say as long as girls have not having equal opportunity to boys, as long as they are not seen as equal, there's still a need to highlight and give that a spotlight to girls and to bring it to the attention of the world that girls, well, girls are half the world.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, it's a huge miss opportunity if they don't get to fulfill, to participate fully in social, cultural and economic rights.
Yeah, because I was reading, you know, I was reading on the UNICEF website, actually, every 10 minutes somewhere in the world, an adolescent girl dies as a result of violence. In humanitarian emergencies, gender-based violence often increases, subjecting girls, as you mentioned, to sexual and physical violence, child marriage, exploitation, trafficking. And in conflict zones, for example, 90% girls are more likely to be out of school, again, as you mentioned. So I suppose in the hierarchy of bad things happening, girls tend to be at the lowest rung.
Well, that's it. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And the area of girls' rights encompasses so many difficult things, like we just mentioned, child marriage and all of that, violence, health, reproductive risks. What's the most important issue, the one that we need to tackle first and sort of, you know, in order to tackle the rest?
I think girls' education, because once a girl is educated, that empowers them in many ways. First of all, you know, the longer a girl stays in school, then the less likely they are to get married, the more opportunity they have to be economically viable, to get a job, so they're less dependent on either being sold off for some, or on, you know, finding a husband in order to survive. So then I think also there is a correlation between girls' education and then their own children's survival and development, mm-hmm. and the values that are then instilled to their girl children. So that breaks the cycle of poverty. It breaks the cycle of sort of deprivation for girls. And I think that's the key entry point to changing the situation overall for girls and women globally.
And how would you say UNICEF is working to aid in that, you know, to make sure that girls have equal right and access to education?
Well, we have education has been a priority for UNICEF for, you know, since the get-go.
Yeah.
We collaborate with many other organizations as well to ensure that girls have access to education by doing community mobilization, but also by support improving the standards of education in schools, making sure that schools are girl-friendly, having separate latrines, for example,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of girls would seem to drop out during their menses,
yeah.
and so on. But then also ensuring that the community level, when a girl does drop out, someone goes and verifies why and encourages that girl to come back into school, talking to the parents and so on. So there is then also even just putting water in villages where there is no water. So the girls who often have the burden to go and fetch water with their parents, with their mothers, are relieved of that because now that, you know, the water is there available.
Yeah.
So there is multi-pronged approach, but definitely in terms of working on policy level and working at the community level and working actually with the schools and teacher training and, providing equipment both for the individual student but as well for the schools, approaches that UNICEF has globally.
Okay. And, you know, from your own experiences, maybe you can share one of your best moments in terms of advancing girls' rights, you know, maybe where you saw direct impact of your work improving a young girl's life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in Benin, for education, we saw huge improvements there where we were supporting schools and having child-friendly school initiative and encouraging girls to come to school. That involved putting in water wells, water pumps, as well as rehabilitating schools, training teachers, having girl role models that would go out, female role models that would go around to the villages to encourage their girl child to go to school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we saw an increase in not only in terms of primary school enrollment for girls, but also retention of girls in school and then going on to secondary school. And that is a huge achievement because globally, there's still 263 million children who do not go to school, and the majority of those are girls. And a lot of those are at the secondary, lower secondary and tertiary level. So when you see an improvement on that, then that helps the whole country in terms of their development, but also in terms of girls' rights. Another initiative which I was involved with, which I'm, you know, was very proud of, was in terms of maternal health and support. I mean, some of these villages, it's so hard to get to a health center in time.
Yeah.
And often the decision is made by the man, you know, in terms of when the woman should be referred to a hospital, because there is expense attached to that.
Right.
So first we worked with communities to sensitize men as to the dangers of not referring their wife fast enough if there is a complication during childbirth. Mm-hmm. And then at the health centers, we trained also community midwives,
yeah.
Or traditional birth attendants, rather, to detect the signs of when the mother needed to be referred to a health center.
Yeah.
And we equipped those health centers in the rural areas with radios so that they could alert the hospital if they were going to transfer somebody, so that that hospital was then ready to, bed,
yeah.
and receive that the mother. And that approach really helped to reduce the number of childbirths and maternal deaths. As a result.
That's amazing.
And and it was especially comforting to see men's attitude change towards that, to realize that, you know, it wasn't in anyone's interest for the mother to die, that there was a need to to refer the woman quickly, and for them to increase their understanding and to have a smooth transition.
And I imagine that's also a big part of your work as well. You know, I mean, yes, educating women, but also educating the men about, you know, treating women equally and, you know, the importance of women within, you know, society. Would I be wrong in saying that?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, when you try and work on women's rights, oftentimes, you know, you have to work with the men,
mm-hmm.
and you have to work with community leaders, and you have to work with religious leaders, and it's a joint effort. And also the media have a central role to play. Schools have a central role to play. How women and girls are even depicted in school books, the roles that girls and boys are given in schools,
right.
You know, was the girls that have to clean up, you know, sweep the courtyard, or is it given to both, the sports that they play? It's a whole societal thing, and this is something that UNICEF works on in all our countries where we work, where there's a need. We work at the community level and at district level with district education and other authorities, as well as at the central level.
And you would say you're seeing progress, as you mentioned, you know, the men are also kind of coming up to speed about all the things that they need to know about and the importance of women.
I see there's progress, but there's still a long way to go. Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, when you look at the world today, where there's still areas of so much conflict and poor governance, then, you know, women's rights remain sort of a lower priority to others, to mm-hmm. rights, you know, concerns of survival and economic development or whatever else is going on.
Yeah.
But so the fight goes on, but you can't give up, because where you see, when even if there is a small improvement somewhere, or you've made a difference in one child's life,
yeah.
That's already a success.
And just going to your role, you know, your role as, you know, you're the head and you're also a woman. Have you ever encountered sexism in your line of work?
I think there's sexism still exists. Yes, of course, it would be wrong to say not. But, you know, I would say as much as in any workplace. I'm lucky that now, I mean, in UNICEF, as well as in the UN in general, we have very strong policies to protect women from sexism and zero tolerance for sexual harassment. There are clear reporting mechanisms for such attitudes, and our leaders are expected to squash any of this in the workplace. So it's definitely improved from when I joined in 92, and there is a lot more women as well in positions of leadership from that time, that we have a policy where we within the UN in general, not just UNICEF, to get to parity at leadership level.
Oh, have you ever noticed anything, you know, I mean, you've been working there since 1992, anything consistent among women working in human rights movements, for example, as opposed to their male counterparts? Is there any sort of like, maybe like the women aren't taken as seriously as the men, you know, have you ever encountered things like that?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think when you join the UN, it's a bit like being a missionary or something, you're joining for a cause,
mm-hmm.
and we all share that cause. So we all share the commitment for that cause. And so I haven't, I wouldn't say there's a sort of, we're all individuals, so we're all different. We can't say there's something that distinguishes the women more than the men that work in this field of work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, things have changed a lot since 1992 when you joined. So I'm guessing, you know, people obviously spoke up about things that were not quite right and those sorts of things. And, you know, often when you use your voice, people tend to distance you. They reject you sometimes, or they brand you as, you know, a troublemaker, for example. Have you ever experienced, you know, retribution for speaking up maybe about bias or inequities or anything like that?
I think in on the public side, you know, it's expected of you to speak out. We are the voice of children, and you know, and therefore, and also for women's rights. If you see a violation, you're expected to speak out. If we don't speak out, we're not doing our job. I think you also have to use sometimes, let's say, common sense in how you do it.
Yeah.
And there are times when you might not want to be the one speaking, if you, depending who you need to speak to. If you need to go and speak to a religious leader or who's, say, an extremist, of you might not have as much credibility as if a man went in your place. But that doesn't mean a man can't advocate for women's rights as well as a woman, mm-hmm. Especially if they're working for the UN, because it's our business. So I think, though, if I look at from 92 to now within the workplace, there's a difference, because women were less comfortable speaking out. They were afraid that if they spoke out against their boss, who would be maybe a man, well, if it was a man, then, you know, they wouldn't be listened to. They wouldn't be taken. They wouldn't have credibility. I think that has changed now. With this zero tolerance policy, we've had some quite high profile cases where, you know, the women have been able to speak out, and there was no tolerance for the man who had stepped out of line.
And there you are.
Yes. Yeah. So things have changed now in that respect within the workplace, definitely. I think in public life, it remains the same. We speak out when we need to, and there's no retribution.
That's wonderful. Like you said, a zero tolerance policy, that's, I think, very important. I mean, we've been hearing, I'm sure, about Harvey Weinstein. I'm sure you've heard about that case as well.
Yes.
You know, and there's that insinuation that everyone knew, but they let it happen. So, again, I think having a zero tolerance policy is something that, you know, every organization needs to have when it comes to things like harassment or, you know, gender discrimination.
Yeah, and you see how prevalent it is, I think, now on the Weinstein, sort of, on the wake of Weinstein, you've got this Me Too, hashtag Me Too,
yes.
sort of movement of all the women who somehow in their private life or public life have been exposed to this kind of behavior. And sadly, it still exists. But I think employers globally, no matter about the UN, but all employers, and I think now the film industry is coming out and saying, you know, we are making a stance, this is not acceptable. And employers everywhere need to be able to do that. And I don't think it's being done across the board. And so still it goes on.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, you know, you just have to keep fighting the good fight, right?
Yes.
In all of this, you know, what would you say are some good examples of initiatives or policies that can help women become key players, particularly in the human rights movement?
I'm not sure about policies to get women into a human rights movement as such. I think if women are interested in getting involved, then the door is open. Mm-hmm, I think they can do. I think it's good also when you get more men involved, because as long as it's then seen as sort of, oh, it's just women again, you know, fighting for their rights, same old story, people tend to sort of raise their eyebrows. And that's a shame, because it shouldn't be that way. Mm-hmm. I think we need to get to a stage now. And I mean, it pains me that after, you know, more than 50 years since the conventional elimination of discrimination against women, we're still talking about these issues. We're still having to fight. And it shouldn't be that way now. We should have evolved beyond that. I mean, more and more women do have access to education. And they, as well as their male counterparts, should be fighting for a more equal world. I think within the workplace, definitely zero tolerance policies, leadership courses that encourage both men and women to have a conducive work environment with equal opportunities. Those are all policies that are good, policies that help women to stay in the workforce as they have, you know, or come back to the workforce after they've had children. These are also good policies. And I think acceptance for diversity in society, where you don't have these gender stereotypical roles, where there is pressure from families that, you know, the woman should give up their work once they have child, you know, once they've had children and that it's the man should continue. I think that's, you know, that's not necessarily the case.
look at your own case.
Yes, look at my own case. But I think, you know, and look at maybe your case. There are many women who, it doesn't mean the man should necessarily stay at home, but it needs to be a joint decision. It shouldn't be the expectation that is the role of the woman. It has to be a choice. And if that's the woman's choice, then that's okay as well.
And, you know, just to go back to something you mentioned earlier about how when women have education, you know, it tends to go on to the next generation as well. And speaking of your own next generation, you mentioned you have children, two children, if I'm not mistaken. How do you sort of teach them about respecting human rights, you know, especially the rights of girls and women?
Well, I think, I mean, they've
just watch through, you.
Well, yes. I mean, they've gone, they've lived in all the countries I've lived in, except for Somalia, of course. And, but they've, you know, so they've gone to the field, with me, you know, out into the villages. They've seen some of the work that UNICEF has done and that I've been involved with. So they're very aware in that way. But also through the schools that they've been to, they've learned about children's rights, they've learned about human rights. And I feel proud that my children are very aware. They have a lot of empathy for how others live. They have a sort of a global view of the world. And I think, you know, for my daughter, she's definitely very strong, strong-headed, I would say, an independent young woman. And my son is a fine young man who I think whichever woman lands up with him would be very lucky, because he'd be very respectful of her.
Okay. And just to conclude, Marianne, I mean, what sort of message would you like to leave, you know, anyone who's listening, you know, especially with regard to the rights of women and children? You know, what would you like everyone to know or to keep with them?
We are all human beings, basically, and we make up this world. So there isn't one that is superior to the other by birth or by gender or by race. And I think in that way, in the 21st century, it's important that we have equal opportunities, equal rights. We have different roles, maybe, within society, in that, you know, men are not going to have children. But that doesn't make one inferior to the other. I think once you educate a girl, you educate a nation, you help the development of that nation, and the world's a better place when women have equal opportunities to men. And it shouldn't just be the women's role to fight for that. I think it's time for men to step up as well.
Okay. And if we'd like to get in touch, or, you know, to find out more about the work that UNICEF does, or maybe to volunteer, is that something that UNICEF is looking for?
We're definitely looking for champions to support our cause in any way. And you're welcome to visit our website and, yeah, to get in touch, see how you can get involved in our work and supporting the work that we do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Marianne. I've been speaking to Marianne Clark-Hutting. She is the representative in Malaysia for the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF. And we've been discussing her work and also how she's helping in her own way to create a better world for girls and women. If you'd like to find out more about UNICEF, that website again is unicef.org/Malaysia. This has been Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.